The mission is simple, to help high achievers naturally eliminate emotional and physical obstacles so they can optimize their life for higher achievement. Welcome. You have just entered the Genesis Zone.
Good day and welcome back to the Genesis Zone show. This is Dr. Brian Brown. Thank you for joining us today. We are joined on today's show by Maricela Robles. She's back. And she's back as an expert this time. Last time we had her on to talk about her origin story and some of the hurdles that she overcame with professional burnout to get her where she is today. So today she's going to be talking to us as an expert. Now, Maricela is an environmental lawyer turned children's author and certified meditation teacher who helps parents effortlessly introduce meditation to their children through bedtime or anytime stories for that matter. Her genius as a storyteller lies in writing storybooks like You Don't Need Your Body to Sail a Boat and Why Does Mommy Always Sleep Sitting Up? That actually get children asking their parents to meditate instead of the other way around after the very first reading. In addition, Maricela provides parents with all the tools they need to start a meditation practice themselves and get their kids meditating through her website, Meditation Fairy. Maricela lives in Switzerland with her husband and young son. When not writing on her laptop or scribbling ideas on her notebook, or notepad, you can find Maricela analyzing the newest animated movie with her son or exploring mountain hiking trails in beautiful Switzerland. In this servant leader segment, Maricela will be sharing her expert knowledge in the area of meditation. Actually, she's going to demystify it for us and share how it's literally so easy a child can do it. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Genesis Zone show today, Maricela. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm super excited to be back. I had so much fun last time. I'm really looking forward to this.
Yes, I am too. So as an expert in meditation, let's just kind of dive right in. We got a really good overview of your personal backstory, your professional backstory last time, and how that led you through burnout into healing, and how meditation played an integral part of that. But I think for many people, meditation can be this somewhat mystical thing that people may be a little bit afraid of. They may be a little bit leery of. And I understand from having had conversation with you in the past that there's actually some science behind this. Let's start with the science of meditation and just understanding the brain and stress and go from there. And we'll just kind of construct the interview from that point.
Yes, for sure. So yes, you're right. Sort of meditation. I mean, I used to think that as well, right? Like It's just for Tibetan monks or for some hippie people sort of sitting, you know, and you have to be in this, you know, either in front of the ocean or in this like beautiful deck with a meditation mat and, you know, all the gear and in robes, and then you can meditate. And that's all, you know, it's not true. You know, trying not to swear. But that's absolutely not true. I mean, you can meditate anywhere where you can close your eyes, or you can close your eyes, or even when you don't close your eyes, you can still do a meditation. So I think that's the first thing, to say, I think, and for people who have been thinking about it, who have maybe even tried it and it didn't quite work, there isn't, you know, contrary to what many people might say, because some people feel very passionate about the type of meditation that they actually practice, There isn't one type of meditation. There isn't the right one or the only one thing. You know, it isn't trademarked. It's not. Meditation is a lot of things. There are some meditations that have been, or some type of meditations or systems, let's say, that have been trademarked, like transcendental meditation. Like you can't teach that unless you've gone through the training of the people who sort of created it. But at the end of the day, when you start looking at the different types of meditations, I mean, that's just a mantra-based meditation, for example. And when I say mantra-based is when you are repeating something, a mantra that it can be an affirmation. Mm. It can be in English, in your own language. It can be in Sanskrit. So you have no idea what you're saying, but you get the feeling of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And then you repeat it over and over again. There are the silence meditations where you just sit down in silence and meditate. There are guided meditations. Yoga is a type of meditation, which was actually developed by the monks all those years ago, because they realized, like, gosh, we're sitting for 10 hours a day meditating. We need to move our body, but we still want to do it in a meditation type of way. So let's develop this sort of exercise, movement, stretching system to be able to then meditate. To meditate. So when you're doing very conscious yoga, you are doing, it's effectively meditation in motion. You can do walking meditations, you can do laughing meditations, you can do dancing meditations. So there isn't one thing. So please don't be put off by if you tried one. And I heard this sort of analogy ages ago, and I thought it was really funny. When they said it's like going on one bad date and then thinking, that's it, I'm never dating again. This is not for me. That wasn't the one for you, but it doesn't mean that there isn't something else out there that might work better for you.
Right.
So that's the first thing probably to sort of get out of the way. And if somebody tells you, if you're not doing it like this, then you're wrong, then don't listen to them. Either they feel extremely passionate about what they're doing and how they're doing it and how they're doing it, or they're just not as well informed. Because at the end of the day, there's many, many, many different ways. And it's about finding the right one for you that will get you going, that will get you interested enough in doing it, which is the one that's going to work for you and your lifestyle and your family as well at the end of the day. So that's number one. And so if we now when I'm teaching meditation to parents, one of the first things that I start with them is we talk about stress. Now, why do we talk about stress? Because most people who, unfortunately, like myself, who come into meditation as a last resort. Like they've tried everything else. And I get it. I did that too. I tried the medication. I tried the essential oils. I tried the acupuncture. I tried everything else and nothing stuck and nothing worked. And it's almost like it's being used as a sort of, well, you know, nothing else worked. I might as well try this, right? Which I'm trying very, very hard to change that perspective, because I truly believe, knowing what I know now, I truly believe that is something so basic, so essential, that if we all learn it when we are children, we will be able to deal with everything that life throws at us so much better. We will be so much better equipped to handle it emotionally, to be kinder to people, to be better human beings with each other. If we had that awareness and that conscious and that understanding of ourselves and of others. But if you have been looking into meditation at some point or another, it's probably because you're like, oh, I just need to relax. I just need to relax and calm down. I just want to feel better. I want to sleep better. I want to, you know, not have so much anxiety. And yes, that's how I ended up into meditation as well. I needed something to make me feel better. And the reality is that meditation is excellent at that, right? It helps you be able to lower your stress levels considerably. And so why stress and how does that work? It all has to do with the mind, right? And because it all starts with our head. You can do as many stretches of your legs as you want, and you can do as many, you know, whatever. So imagine the meditation is like the exercise for the mind, or the stretching for the mind, if we want to think about it in that way.
Great analogy.
So what happens is, so we have three important parts that I always talk about, and we have the prefrontal cortex, which is, at the front sort of our forehead area.
Right.
And that's where we make decisions, right? Is the, it's the basically analytical part, the decision part of our brain that uses sort of logic to determine, what we're going to do. Then we have the amygdala, which is sort of in the middle. I can't really point it. Mm-hmm. But the amygdala is like, to kids, I always tell, it's like this really sort of jumpy Amy. I say she's very stressed all the time, trying to figure out what's wrong and what's happening and what's happening. And the job of the amygdala is actually to assess threats, right? Mm-hmm. So it's about finding out what is going on and what can kill you. Mm-hmm. And exactly it right. does a very good job, right?
Yep.
And then you have the hippocampus, which is about learning and about memory and long-term memory as that as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens when there's a threat in front of you, right? The amygdala gets activated and then it immediately tells the prefrontal cortex, oh my God, there's, an elephant in the way, or there's a serpent, or there's a lion, and it's going to kill us. And then the prefrontal cortex goes like, okay, that's a movie. You don't need to be stressed, amygdala. And it's sort of the job of the prefrontal cortex to assess logically whether that threat will occur, or what is the likelihood of occur, or what is the likelihood of occurring. And if it is a threat that we determine, like, oh, shoot, we really, yes, there is really an elephant here and we really need to run, then it's the job to then send information of the amygdala, to send information down to the hypothalamus that then releases the cortisol and the adrenaline and everything, so that we go into the, the typical, the fight, flight or freeze responses, right?
Right.
Which then shut everything else down, so that you have enough energy in your limbs to be able to run like heck mm-hmm. or fight that, lion, or hide and freeze. Right. Whatever it is that it's deemed that you have to do in that moment to be able to survive. Remember, this is very survival instinct at its finest. It is, we are a well-oiled machine that works perfectly when everything else is working perfectly. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, here's the kicker. When you are under chronic stress, that communication stops working, really. There's no, the prefrontal cortex can't properly assess that logic, can properly assess if the threat is real or not, or what the situation. And so what ends up happening is, it ends up being sort of the amygdala ends up being overactive. Mm-hmm. And then we end up being overwhelmed. We find it difficult to make decisions because the prefrontal cortex ends up being like, wait, I don't know. I'm not getting information. I don't know what to do. I can't make a decision. And then everything, basically, we're constantly releasing stress hormones into our body.
Right.
And
I always say that, that there's danger confusion with the prefrontal cortex, because we don't have a lot of lions and serpents and elephants walking around in our everyday life like our mm-hmm. ancestors did.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets confused and it's not really able to interpret the environment as, okay, that is truly a danger. It's not. So it just defaults to, okay, on the safe chance that it is, boom, let's just release stress. That's stress chemicals.
Because my boss is looking like a lion at the moment.
Right.
And so maybe
exactly.
That might be threatening. Yeah. Or, this person who shouted at me on the street was really aggressive. So that might be threatening.
Yeah.
And so we've our body, because of the way our lives are at the moment, has resorted, like you say, to become stressed and think that it constantly is under survival. Mm-hmm. Without actually being afforded the luxury of being able to close that cycle.
Right.
And to, because it's meant to be a cycle. It's meant to be like, there's a threat. Either I assess it, I determine that it isn't a threat, and I go back to my baseline.
Correct.
Or there's a threat, I confront it, I release everything, I run, I fight, I do whatever it is. And then once it's finished, I go back to my baseline. Mm-hmm. It's almost like there's a threat. Oh, there's another threat. There's another threat. There's another threat. There's another threat. We never go back to baseline.
Right. Which, it's like we take a biological system that was only meant to be activated for 5 to 15 minutes, and we make it activated for, you know, as we talked about in the previous interview with you, 23 hours. So it stays constantly activated.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, when you think about it and you say, well, okay, but, you know, it doesn't matter. That's the way that modern life is. And we just have to adjust. And you can't, you know, modern life, as we know it, this constant on, it hasn't been that long. You know, it hasn't been, I mean, if you think about it, even like telephones at homes, you know, there haven't been around or that long, or TVs at home that are constantly informing you, even back in the day with,
you
only had one TV, right? It hasn't been that long. What has it been, like, you know, 80 years or less than that? You know, so our bodies have adjusted throughout, you know, much, much longer than that, you know, not even hundreds, but thousands of years. And it's crazy to think like, well, you know, we're just going to adjust in the next sort of 10 years and it's going to be fine.
That's right.
So that's not how it works necessarily. So what happens is that then used people who are then under stress and under chronic stress end up realizing that, oh, you know, my belly hurts all the time, or I'm intolerant to this, or, you know, I'm having trouble digesting, or, you know, I can't sleep because my mind is racing, and they can't figure out why. And the why is because when you're in survival, it is not time to digest. You need to be running or freezing or fighting. It is not time to relax. That's the last thing that you want to do when you have a lion in front of you. No, you're not going to reproduce either. So for women trying to get pregnant, it's just not going to happen because the body knows that the chances of that reproduction surviving at the moment, that's not what you want to do. And you can't create. It is not a moment to be creative and have ideas and, you know, see opportunity, you know, see opportunities and chances. It's not. And so all of a sudden you've shut down all of these really key pieces. So you can't rest, you can't digest, you can't reproduce. And then let's say we drop the creativity, but that's what sort of gives us also happiness and meaning and purpose. And then you're like, well, I'm just on a, you know, I'm this constant wheel and I'm feeling awful. And you're like, well, yes, no wonder, because you're constantly in that survival instinct. So then you go like, well, how do I solve it? How do I get out of that wheel? Right. Okay. And for that, you then have to go back and to say, you know, like, as we chatted last time, you have to become very aware and conscious of, well, what's triggering you? What is your thought process every day? What are you going through? You know, why is it affecting you so much? Is it affecting you so much when your boss looks at you in a certain way? Or why do you keep replaying that, you know, the time when your neighbor shouted at you and it made you feel awful and you didn't know what to reply? And then you keep playing that conversation over and over again, becoming really angry and reliving that situation. And here's the thing and this to me was, you know, from a storytelling perspective, this is why marketing with storytelling is so effective, for example, because the brain doesn't know the difference of something that you're telling it as a story and something that is happening in reality. So that's why when I say to you at the moment, if I were to say, okay, imagine your favorite food, or let's say it's a really hot day and I say, oh, imagine, you know, this ice cream cone, and it can be vanilla or chocolate, your favorite ice cream cone, and it's really hot and you're really dying for it and you're sweating and you're looking at it and it's in your hand now and you're about to give, you know, take a lick or a bite of that ice cream cone, your mouth inevitably will start watering.
Yep.
Your belly inevitably will start creating juices, preparing itself to receive the food. Mm-hmm. Because your brain doesn't know that you're imagining it versus seeing it in front of you. And that's really key to understanding stress and to understanding why, when we had something that happened in the past, when we had a traumatic event, or when we became very angry with our boss, every time we relive that, we're reliving that feeling, that anger, that frustration, that stress, every single time by thinking about it.
That's an excellent point. So what you're saying is the brain doesn't know the difference between the thoughts that are going on in your head and actual reality. Mm-hmm. The two are the same as far as the way it's interpreted.
And as far as the way it reacts, because you have a physical reaction. Mm-hmm. So if you have a physical reaction of your mouth watering when you're imagining your favorite food, what do you think the physical reaction is going to be when you're remembering how pissed off you were because, you know, somebody else took your spot in the parking or wherever it is that you do? Like, it's that same, because, and you can remember it, it's like a rush and you feel inside and you get all tensed up and you get, you know, all of that. You can really, your heart rate will increase. Mm-hmm. Everything will just go into, you know, because your body is preparing itself because it doesn't know, It's thinking, oh, shoot, this threat is happening again. Let me prepare for it. And so it works. Stories work in many wonderful ways in immersing us in situations. You know, that's why we love sort of, you know, what they say, stories about escapism, which, you know, have been so obviously popular during the pandemic because people just want to escape. Because that's why we enjoy it so much. We enjoy being told that story because we feel transported to another, you know, to another situation. We cry, we laugh, we then yell out involuntarily, no, at the TV, you know, even though we know it's not happening, but we can't help ourselves because in a way our brain doesn't know the difference, right? And so if our brain doesn't know the difference and we're constantly reliving a moment that made us stressed, then you're just constantly in that stress. You haven't let it go and you haven't moved past it. And that's all in our thoughts. And what meditation helps you to do, and if you're if you want a really, let's say, simple or easy definition of meditation, is really about retraining our attention. To make sure that, and when I talk about retraining my attention, I mean retraining our thoughts, because where are you putting your attention? If your attention is in your thoughts, that your thoughts are going to do, let's say you wake up in the morning and you think, oh, I'm going to make myself some coffee, but first I'm going to have a shower, and but first, so you're lying on your bed and your mind is already three steps or four steps ahead of what you're going to do, right? Instead of being in this moment where you've just woken up and you can stretch, you can feel your body, you can be in contact, become aware of your surroundings, see what everything is. Your mind is already somewhere else. And when you're meditating, it's about retraining that attention, bringing that focus and bringing those thoughts to the moment, and developing an ability to be able to observe those thoughts in a non-judgmental way. And I know that that sounds a bit weird, and you're like, well, you know, if I'm not going to do it in a non-analytical way or in a non-judgmental way, like how does that work? Because if you think about it, when you have a thought or an event or an experience, you are adding your emotions to that thought or that event or that experience.
That's right.
Okay. And so then that thing or event becomes more than what it is because of what you are putting to it or what you're associating to it. And through meditation, what you can learn or what it teaches you is to be able to detach yourself and your thoughts and emotions from, to be able to not attach them, let's say, to that thing or event or experience. And let me give you an example. I do this. This is one of the exercises that I do with my students when we're talking about at the beginning about how to retrain and how to focus your attention. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I pick up an object, and to them I have, you know, I have a little fish that I have at home. It's one of these really beautifully decorated sort of alebrijes, which maybe you have heard about now that with mm-hmm. cocoa, probably everybody knows. It's a sort of very colorful fish. And I say, okay, we're going to do this. I want you to look at the fish and only the fish. And when you start thinking about something else, then you need to bring back your attention to the fish. Because what happens is I show them the fish and then they start thinking, oh, yes, that's a beautiful, colorful fish. And then they go, oh, I remember when I went fishing with my dad. Oh, when I was fishing with my dad, I got sunburned and I was really scared and I felt really bad for it. And then he told me off and then it was awful. And that started the whole demise of my, relationship with him. And you're like, wait, what? Sorry, we were at the fish. But we have, you know, it's this natural sort of instinct that our mind just starts running because it starts associating and recalling thoughts and memories to that thing because it wants to make sense of it. So it wants to recall memories to see, okay, so it's a fish. Let me remember the last time you saw a fish so that we understand it more. But then you go somewhere else and somewhere else and somewhere else. And all of a sudden you're now angry because your dad told you off at that time when you were six, you know, at about ages ago. And so what you're trying to do, what I'm trying to teach them with this exercise, and sometimes, you know, they start to look at it and I always put a timer and I put a timer for about 15 seconds the first time. And then I put a timer for 30 seconds and then I put a timer for 1 minute. And usually the first 10 seconds, they're okay, 10, 15 seconds, because they're so, you know, there's so many colors to the fish that they're like, oh, just looking at the colors and looking at the thing. When we hit 30 seconds, they're like, oh, I went somewhere else. 45 seconds, oh, I went more places. And you start realizing you're like, damn, I can't, you know. And the simpler the object, so I've done that with a pen, then sometimes it just lasts 4 to 5 seconds before actually they start thinking about something else. And so that when you meditate, what you're trying to do is you're trying to retrain your brain and almost like ordering it and saying, you have to focus your attention here on this thing. And you're going to learn as if this was, you know, a training, like if you're a horse or whatever, you're going to learn that you have to pay your attention here and nowhere else because I'm telling you to do so. And that little exercise, if you've never meditated before, try it. It is an excellent exercise. I do it with kids as well. They love it. It's an excellent exercise on focus and concentration. Especially now with kids, you know, being so exposed to e-learning and all of that,
right.
It helps them bring their attention back, Because at the end, that's what the practice is to bring your attention back, to this specific time and moment where you want it to be, not where it's all over the place on its own. You want to have that controller. So,
it's interesting that you're talking about attention and focus, because I think one of the saddest things that happens, especially in an education type of setting, is we want to be quick to say that this child has ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and because they can't focus. And really, I think it, in some ways, not to say that ADHD doesn't exist, but in some ways, I think what you're saying in a very simplistic form is that it very well could just be an untrained brain, you know, that we haven't trained that brain to focus correctly. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah. Many children I've spoken with many specialists on ADHD and they all agree that whenever the first time, let's say that, you know, a child, especially with sort of more holistic, either medical, holistic sort of staff, doctors that think, okay, I want to assess the child as a whole and not just sort of here you go, here's a pill.
Right.
They all agree that when children start practicing meditation, mindfulness, especially children who their thinking might be diagnosed with ADHD, they go back to baseline, and then they no longer present any of the symptoms that they were saying, wow. Oh, they have it. And even when children do have ADHD and have been diagnosed after proper assessments and all of that, still meditation and mindfulness helps them enormously to be able to cope with the condition. So in any case, sort of the treatment as to whether they might be or they are, or you don't know, it's the same.
Right. I say
meditation, mindfulness will help them to be able to deal with it. And so it's really, that's why I say that it's as important. I mean, we should be teaching them right next to, you know, maths and sciences. Huh. Like, we are all going, you know, in one way or another, we are all going have to confront at some point pain, frustration, stress, you know, anger, sadness. And yet no one tells us how to deal with it. We are not taught how to deal with it. Right. We are not taught how to be uncomfortable in the face of those emotions, even with others. I mean, I remember, you know, as a parent, your child starts crying and all you want them to do is to stop.
Right.
You're like, stop, don't cry, stop. It'll be okay. Why? It's an emotion. We are not comfortable with being uncomfortable. And sometimes that child will need that space to be able to process that emotion, understand that it is an emotion and that it will come and that it will go. Because the problem is we teach them to repress. And when we teach them to repress sadness, we teach them to repress anger, we teach them to repress all of the so-called negative emotions, And when you repress, what happens? Inevitably they will come up.
Right.
Inevitably at, you know, people say the most unexpected moments, you know, and they're like, oh, it came out of nowhere. You're like, no, it wasn't nowhere. It was somewhere there.
Right. Right.
We've just been repressing it for such a long time.
That's right.
Exactly. And what happens with meditation, with what you can do, is that you learn to become aware of yourself, of your emotions, of how you react. And so then you can say, oh, I'm feeling sad. Okay, that's interesting. Why am I feeling sad? Where is this coming from? Or I'm feeling angry. You know, why is this making me feel angry? And then inevitably we realize that everything sort of comes back to us. We say, oh, you know, for example, I was actually talking this morning to some of the students. I was saying, when, you know, she's like, oh, but, you know, my kids, like, you know, when they're asleep, they look so peaceful. And I say, oh, I'm going to become the best mom today. I'm going to be amazing because they deserve it. She's like, and then they wake up and they start screaming and they start telling me things. and then I go like, ah,
yeah.
She's like, how do I deal with that? I was like, no, I get it. I have those mornings too. I said, but when you start analyzing, why are you getting angry? So let's say, let's take the screaming, right? My child is screaming at me and it's making me angry. Why? Well, because I think it's impolite, and because he's an impolite child and he's not been well educated, for example.
It's a sign of disrespect.
Yeah. But then that means that I'm doing the educating. So then I'm the wrong one at educating him. So then that goes back on me then. And then, you know, it must mean he doesn't love me. Oh, so I feel bad then because I think that him shouting means he doesn't love me. Okay, that goes back on me. And then, I'm embarrassed by what other people might think. Oh, so it's me who's embarrassed by what other people might be thinking or not of me. Okay, that goes back on me. So when you start analyzing, you start realizing that that anger and that trigger of a child screaming has very, very little to do with the child actually screaming than it has with everything else that you are attributing to that screaming and that shouting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that, but unless you are analyzing your thoughts, you are becoming aware, of what's happening and how you're reacting, what you're doing, you're always going to think that it's somebody else's fault. You're always going to think that everybody else is wrong and you are right. And you're always going to blame everyone and everything else for how you are feeling.
Right.
Because it's them. They made me feel this way. They made me feel bad. They made me, you know, it's always them that are affecting me. I'm okay. Everybody else is wrong. And so there's an aspect of humility that comes with it where you really have to accept where a lot of it is on you, you know, and I think a lot of people are not ready for it because they're not wanting or willing to accept that they're wrong, which, come on, we're wrong all the time. I mean, we can't know everything. Most of the time we're wrong.
Right.
Even the experts, then they prove things and then they disprove them.
That's exactly right.
So, but that at the end of the day, on a very basic level, is what meditation can do. And this has been proven in so many different ways. I mean, if you look at the brain waves of our brain waves and what happens. So normally we are on beta brain waves, which you probably know, right? Beta brain waves.
Right, beta.
Beta, sorry, yes. I forgot the name in English for a moment. So beta brain waves. And that's us being awake, being alert, being sort of doing stuff and, you know, we're focusing and we're doing things and we're just going through the normal. And then when you start looking at the different brain waves as you go down, the next one is alpha.
Alpha.
And that's relaxed focus. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. That's it. It aids long-term memory, and that's associated with light meditation, what they call, which is probably the meditation that, as beginners and everything, we are attempting to do. We're attempting to relax our bodies, relax our minds, and just go from a state of high alertness to just, okay, let me go back. Remember when I talk about baseline, that we don't know what baseline is? It's going down to that baseline. And then you have delta, which is sleep, effectively. Right. And that's why a lot of people, the first time that they meditate, they fall asleep.
Uh-huh.
They say, it doesn't work for me. I always fall asleep. Well, no, it's because you're learning and you're getting so relaxed that inevitably you're falling into sleep. And it's normal. And it
happens. That's a good point. I've never heard anybody say it that way, but... that's an excellent point that you make, because so many people, when they do first start out meditating, they will say, oh, it didn't work. I fell asleep. Exactly. And it is because they're going into that delta wave sleep. That's a great point. Love it.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, hey, I've been in retreats where people have been snoring next to me. So, you know, it happens to everyone and even to long-term meditators as well. So now after delta, you have theta. Theta. Right. And theta is associated with deep meditation. Mm. So it's really, then you have spontaneous healings. You have really amazing insights, amazing, you know, it's almost, a lot of people refer to them as downloads. All of a sudden you get up and you're like, oh, but you're not asleep.
And respiratory rate slows down to 4 or 5 breaths per minute. Yeah,
exactly. You feel very relaxed. It's almost like you're in another state. Mm-hmm. And then after theta comes gamma.
Gamma.
And that's just like the magical fairyland. Magical fairyland, effectively. And I say it like that because if you look at sort of the hertz and what each one of the brain waves is doing, beta starts at, you know, 14, sort of 30, and then it goes down to 9, and then it goes down below 4, and then sort of 4 and 8. And then gamma goes up to 30. And you're like, wait, what? How can it be at 30, which is effectively the same as beta or more? It goes above 30. And you're still in this sort of deep meditating state, which that has been registered. So when they have done these exercises on people who have been beginner meditators, long-term meditators, and monks. The monks achieve gamma. And you're like in, you know, this is like heightened perception. This is like, you know, I'm seeing the world in 3D kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. As they say. Now, you don't have to, you know, as a meditator, you don't have to aspire to gamma, right? Just learning how to go into alpha, just learning how to go into that baseline will already help you massively.
Right.
Why? Because most of us who have lived with stress or under chronic stress or are working and just chugging along and et cetera, we have forgotten what baseline feels like. I remember clearly when I was going through all of the, you know, the different therapists and the different things and the different that, trying to sort of figure out a way out of you know, my depression and my burnout and all of that. I remember I was going with a chiropractor and she's like, oh, how are you? And I was like, oh, you know, I said, well, you know, I go to sleep, you know, at a normal time and I wake up in the morning and I'm just exhausted. I can't wait to go to sleep again. And I joked, I said, yeah, but I guess that's just adulting, right? Ha ha. That's just being a mom. And she turned to me with a straight face and she's like, no. She's like, you should not feel that way. That is not normal to be feeling that level of exhaustion and to be feeling, you know, in that way, you should wake up rested. And I was like, I just looked at her and I was like, really? So I was shocked. I mean, I had, you know, I was a lawyer. I was working all hours and weekends and sometimes the weekends blended into the weeks and I didn't have time off. And it had been so long, so long since I had felt calm and at ease and rested that I had forgotten. And I thought that what I was living, I thought that was the normal. That was the normal. And it's not normal. It's not normal. We should not be under constant survival and constant stress. We need to be able to realize what our baseline is and go back to that level of calm and wellness. And I'm not talking about enlightenment of at the top of the mountain. I'm just talking about an overall feeling of I've gone to bed and I've had a good rest and I feel good now. And I feel like I can, you know, I feel like I can do things. I feel with energy. I want to go out. I want to do things. I feel well in my body and myself.
And I think it's important for people, listeners, to understand that, you know, in your last, in your first interview, the last segment that we did, you said it took a couple of months for you to really start noticing that, oh man, this is really working And so I think that's important for people to hear. It's like, don't meditate once and expect major things to happen. It's going to be a practice. Just like you said at the beginning of the show, it's exercise for your brain. Yes. Just like we work our muscles, we need to work our brain and we need to exercise that brain. And the second thing is that you touched on briefly in this segment earlier, is that when we go into that meditation state, we do it in a non-judgmental way. We're that third party observer, observing those things that are going on within us, but in a non-judgmental way towards ourselves and towards others. I think that's what I heard you say. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, yeah. Precisely. And you're so right. I'm glad you made that point because a lot of people want to use meditation as if it was a medicine. Like, oh, I'm going to
Or a whipping post. Or a whipping post to beat themselves up.
Yeah, that's true as well. And they say, okay, you know, I take an aspirin or whatever, and then my headache goes away. It works. Right. I do a meditation. My anxiety didn't go away. It doesn't work. And that's not how long did it take you to create the anxiety or the depression or everything that you've done, right? Versus how long is it going to take you to go back to that baseline? And the funny thing, the interesting thing is that it will take you less because you could have been for years under that, creating that anxiety. And I meditated daily for 2 months and I started noticing big changes. And I had been in
going on year. After your migraines had been going on for two years, right?
Yeah. So the depression had been going on for 2 years, and then the migraines had been going on for about a year after that. So we're talking about a 3 year backlog.
Right. So this didn't happen overnight.
No, exactly.
And the reversal didn't happen overnight, but in the grand scheme of things, it was very short.
It sort of did. Exactly. I didn't have to wait 3 years to then get better. Mm. I was able to start feeling noticeable changes and benefits out of those 2 months. And then as I kept going, it just kept getting better and better and better, obviously. Mm. But there were some weeks at the beginning where I was like, oh, this is awful. And, you know, the body, I was like, I was hot and I was cold and I was sweating and I was like uncomfortable and everything is itching and I don't want to do this. But I was like, nope, I'm going to do this. Because your body is so used to you being stressed and in that state. It's so familiar. And it's like, no, this is unknown. I'd rather stay in the familiar shitty place, pardon my French, than actually move into a situation where I might get better, but I don't know. And why does the body do that? Because it's the survival instinct. It would rather deal with whatever it's dealing now, which has still kept it, you know, semi-functioning and alive, than actually do something that might make it so much better. So you get that resistance as well. But yeah, sorry.
No, I'm going to put a little pressure on people in the listening audience, because for those of you guys who may not know, you should be able to, based on the introduction that I gave for Maricela, she teaches children how to do this. So for those adults that are sitting out there listening and they're thinking, oh, I can't do this. It just takes too much time. I don't have time for it. You know, we make time for what's important to us. And if a child can grasp these concepts, then adults can grasp these concepts as well. I think in many ways, children are probably more open to it than adults are, because adults have developed so many bad habits over the course of their life and so many preconceived notions, I think, beliefs that aren't necessarily true. Share with us as we wrap up how you've come to work with children, kind of that journey, because I understand you kind of segued into children and then realize, oh, if I don't teach parents how to do this, I'm not helping the children as much as I could. So let's talk a little bit about that journey and wrap up from there.
Yeah. So with kids, as you say, I mean, with kids, they'll do two or three sessions and they're already feeling amazing and they're already get so much better. I mean, why? Because like you say, they're not carrying this history that we as adults are carrying, and all the preconceived notions about whether this is going to work, whether this is not going to work, they're not dealing with that. Now, I do want to say something that a lot of people say, kids don't need to learn about meditation. They're already living in the moment. So they don't need to learn anything about that. Yes, children are very good at living in the moment, but they're also very good at modeling, which means that as they get older, they start looking at what everybody else is doing around them. And they're like, oh, mommy is screaming all the time. Daddy is angry all the time. They feel like that. And they start picking up all of that, all of those little bad habits from parents, from teachers, from other students. And then all of a sudden, that's why you get children with anxiety and committing suicide at 9 years old. You know, which is still unbelievable, because I'm like, what can a 9 year old be going through that it leads them to that moment? So if you're thinking my child mustn't need it because he's living in the moment, no, don't think about that moment. Think about the tool that you're giving them for later. Because just like anything else, just like they had to learn how to walk and just like they had to learn how to use their cutlery to eat or their chopsticks or whatever it is, it's the same. You're also teaching them how to do these, to do these things. And with children, like I say, people say, no, okay, but children can't meditate. They're not going to sit down and meditate. They do. They do. Now, when I started meditating, so the reason why I started getting into meditation for kids is because I realized, like, I was like, oh my God, when I started feeling all of this incredible changes, I thought, if only I had known this when I was a kid, so many things would have been different. And I felt this incredible urge. I was like, I need to teach this to my son. Mind you, he was 4 at the time. He was about to turn 4, I think. Mm. And I was like, okay, what do I do? What do I do? And I had always had a passion for writing and I had always written. And I thought, I'm going to tell him a story. I'm going to tell him a story that is just going to talk to him about it and teach him about it. And then he's going to be able to read it and get inspired. Mm. And that's exactly what I did. And now the parents who have bought, I remember the first time, because of course, then the first time the first book came out, and I, you know, there were parents in school that knew sort of, you know, what I was doing and everything. And they were very supportive and they said, oh, I want a book and et cetera. I remember one of the moms came in the next day and she's like, can I get another book, please? And I was like, what happened? Like, did he hate it and break it? Did he throw it? You know, and she's like, no, he really liked it. He wants to get one for his best friend.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, awesome. And then she said, oh, and by the way, he made us sit down in the middle of their living room to close our eyes and look for the magic door. And I was like, why are you complaining? I was like, that's the purpose of the book, is to get them. So this is a child who had never meditated before, ever. And who read the book and saw that there were 2 children opening the magic door inside their heads that took them to a wonderful place where they wanted to be and have a relaxing adventure and said, I want to do it. Mm. They sat down just like the children did in the book, forced his mummy, of course, to do it. And then sat down and started closing his eyes and started meditating after one reading, you know, of a story that talks about meditation. That's how accepting and, you know, kids are. And meditation for kids doesn't necessarily look like meditation for adults, you know, and parents can do the same meditations that kids do. Simple breathing exercises. That's a meditation. Mm-hmm. Manage 3 minutes. And that's a perfect meditation. I do a quick meditation for moms of 3 minutes where you do a sort of, you relax during the first minute. You do breathing during the second minute, and then you do a quick body scan to release any sort of tension during the third minute.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think sometimes people think, okay, I've got to meditate for 45 minutes. And for a busy mom or dad out there, that's like, I don't have time for this. I can't do that for 45 minutes. You're saying it's as simple as 3 minutes.
Exactly. And the thing is, you start wanting more. So when parents tell me, I don't have time to meditate. I said, okay, but you want your child to meditate, right? Yes, but you know, then, and I was like, well, sit down and do it with them. Do a short 5 minute or 6 minute meditation, guided meditation with them. Sit down and really do it. Don't look at them like, oh, this is so cute what you're doing, you know, listening to the meditation. I'm such a good parent for showing you meditation. No. Sit down, close your eyes, and it'll be a bonding moment for you and your child, an activity that you're doing together, and something that you are doing for yourself as well to relax, to allow you to relax. It doesn't have to get any more complicated than that.
Yeah.
It can if you want to,
right?
But it doesn't have to, right? It can just be that simple, that breathing, because I cannot overstate the importance of breathing and how much it can take us back to baseline. Mm-hmm. You know, when you do deep breaths, when you do, especially from the belly, you expand it all the way up to the chest, do that 3 times and you will immediately start feeling better at that moment. Mm-hmm. And then you can add more and more and more and more. And then what happens is, the kids then ask for it, because when the kids start practicing, then they start catching you out. I mean, I'll have my son now, he's 7. And I was, the other day, I don't know, I was talking with my mom, and my mom doesn't hear very well, especially when we're like on FaceTime. And I find myself like, mom, time. And I find myself like, mom, no, do this. Sort of raising my voice. And he turns to me and he says, "Mommy, I know you might be feeling frustrated, but it's not so nice to be increasing your voice. It's making me feel a bit uncomfortable. Can you please lower it and maybe close your eyes and take a deep breath?" And I was like, yeah, okay, I think I had that coming. Right? And a lot of parents would be like, "How dare you, child, tell me what to do?" Mm. But hey, he's catching me out. I'm grateful for him catching me out in a moment where, you know, maybe I was sort of, I lost it, I was tired, I was whatever. It doesn't matter. Be grateful that somebody is recognizing that for you. Mm. So if kids can do it, you know, then the parents can also do it. And then when you practice together, it becomes normal. Mm. And when you normalize meditation, then just magical things start happening.
That's beautiful. I love that. So interesting projects that you're working on right now. Have you got one or two?
Yeah. So I have, so in total, and I had to do an assessment of this the other day. So I've written 7 books about meditation and mindfulness for kids. And so it's a whole series now, actually. And the first 2 are published. I'm working now with illustrators to sort of determine, okay, which is going to be the next one, the best one as well. Hmm. And I'm also working on, because I'm doing, my courses are currently live. So I do live sessions with the parents and we sit together and I'm sort of, making that a bit more, I want to take that online so that, because of course I'm based in Switzerland, I do it in the morning, based in Switzerland, I do it in the mornings, you know, that basically means it's off limits for people, anywhere else in the world. Right. Mm-hmm. So I want to create that online, but in a way that parents are really going to feel supported and where they can actually pick and choose as well, because I realized that a lot of the, you know, parents, we have a tendency sometimes to say, "I want, you know, fix my child, like just sort him out." Right. And what I've seen is that when parents meditate and they start becoming calmer and they start bringing calm into the home and reacting better, mm-hmm. the quote unquote issues that their children have start disappearing.
Right.
Because they feed off of what we are feeling and what we are giving them. And so I've been working on developing lots of strategies and sort of meditation scripts and mindful scripts and mindfulness exercises and all of that, basically to create this little package for parents to learn how to integrate meditation as a family. Because I think that's always been a bit of a, they're like, "Oh, I don't know how to go about it." Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to want to listen to me. They're not going to want to do this. And throughout my experience, I've sort of been able to test them and try them with my own son and with other kids and see, you know, what easy things parents can do. Mm-hmm. So that's for me is the next step, is sort of taking that, making it available online and trying to make this available in different time zones and all right. of that. So that's the next big project. That and something else, which I can't talk about yet, but yeah. I will tell you as soon as I can.
That's totally fun. So when do you anticipate this first project that you mentioned being ready?
So hopefully it'll be in about 6 weeks. Yeah, I'm hoping so, because all of the material is ready and everything is sort of done. So I just now need to move it into the correct platform and start sort of making all of that available. And then the next one, it'll probably be the summer. It'll probably be the summer by the time that it goes. So
if someone crossed. Wants to find out more about this registration or just get on an early release list. How would they do that?
Yeah. So they just go to my website, meditationfairy.com. And there will be the information there that talks about the course for parents. And basically, if you want to hear about the next ones, or when, then you just register there. Okay. And then I put your name on the list and then you will be able to be informed. And there's a bunch of other goodies there that people can also download if they want to be on my email list as well, where I just share sort of about twice a month. I send, you know, an email sort of with different tips and things that have been going on that I have found to work.
Very good. Very good. Awesome. As usual, I like to end the show with a fun question. So,
the next one,
what is your most unusual talent?
Oh, huh. existing or that I had at some point? Because, maybe, ooh, I think I might have lost you.
Yeah. No, it blanked out and it came back. I don't know what happened.
Oh, there we go. Most unusual talent. I can handle double kung fu swords.
You can what?
So I can handle double kung fu swords and do like a whole sort of, you know,
routine kung fu thing. A kata with kung fu swords.
Yes.
Yeah. So the moral of the story here is people don't mess with Maricela on a bad day. Make sure she's meditated first.
Yes. Meditate. That's when my son goes like, "Mommy, I think you need to meditate today." It's like, okay.
Oh my goodness. Out of the mouths of babes.
Exactly. Exactly right. And I listen.
Well, thank you for another excellent interview segment. Thank you for demystifying meditation for us. I think that's exactly what people need to know about meditation. It's not difficult. We make it more mystified or mystical than it needs to be. We make it more difficult than it needs to be. And it's really not that difficult at all. I love your approach to just the whole aspect of families and children and teaching adults, because kids are modeling what they see in their environment. And from the sounds of things, it sounds like the kids are modeling better for their parents than the parents are for the children.
I know. That's when it becomes a lot of fun. But yes, yeah. I mean, if you've tried it before and it didn't click, try it again with a different person. Yeah. If you've gone to one of, there's so many apps now as well. Tried with one of the apps and you hate the sound of the person's voice, try another person.
Right.
You know, just give it a try. It's
with your inner child and get one of Maricela's books and try that yourself and then try it with your children.
Exactly. Yeah. Actually, we do a connecting with your inner child, meditation throughout the course as well. So there you go. Exactly. Exactly.
I always say that as adults, we are almost 100% dealing with that inner child.
Mm.
Yeah. And if we can tame the inner child, we've got most of the battle won.
Yes, so, exactly. Yeah. Or we can learn to listen to the inner child and understand it. Yeah. Then that's already halfway there.
Yep. Perfect. Absolutely. Well, again, as we wrap up, I'd like to make our listeners aware of something new. Again, I know you've heard me say this before. I recently launched my brand new Gene Hack Bootcamp. And it's gotten rave reviews. And so that means we're going to be doing another bootcamp soon. I haven't announced the date yet, but for this next bootcamp, but I will be soon. In the Gene Hack bootcamp, using my proprietary Genesis Zone method, I teach you how to know exactly which of your five zones are creating lower physical, emotional, and mental performance for you. And I show you exactly which genes need to be checked within each of those zones in order to propel you to higher levels of physical, mental, and emotional performance. If you want more information on that, want to know about the next release for the bootcamp or the next bootcamp, go to drbriangbrown.com/genehack to get on the waiting list. And we'll notify you when that time comes. Tune in tomorrow at noon Eastern Standard Time for my In the Zone segment, where I'll be recapping today's interview with expert Maricela Robles, sharing how the nuggets that she gave to us today fit into the Genesis Zone Advantage. And I'll be answering any questions and exploring other juicy topics and current events. most informed, most trusted, and most grateful you spent this time with us today. Until next time, stay in the zone. This is Dr. Brian Brown.